So I know we're on a time crunch, but can we talk about our frisbee game yesterday at all, even a little bit, please? Just
no,
for a
because
second.
I had a really bad game. So no,
Jackson did have a really bad game. He had a nice little 5 foot pass at the goal line with no one around but him and the dude, and he just kind of laid it in the.
Jackson, I relate to that because like. Even after a lifetime of playing football, I get intimidated playing frisbee just because it's so foreign to me, and I feel weird and out of place. So my heart goes out to you.
But he redeemed himself in overtime, nonetheless.
Is Potsy a great frisbee player?
He was yesterday. I mean, he is.
Specifically yesterday, though. It's been a rough season.
Potsy, what NFL player do you compare your frisbee game to?
How can you ask that on the spot? Let me see. Let's pull up a list of shortest NFL players.
Okay.
It's got to be some like elusive little running back.
Do you like Darren Sproles?
I can see that one.
A little bit of a Darren Sproles.
I can see that one for sure.
Situation.
Mm-hmm.
Boys, we got to get you out for alumni football. Both of you.
Every time someone asks me about it, I come
so
a little
fun.
Bit more around to the idea. But
Potsy, imagine the picture: you, me, and Buddy in our gear, taking a picture on the field.
That could work as as a post for the future Instagram account we were talking about.
That would be incredible.
So
let's think about it.
We've been playing a lot of frisbee for the intramurals, and we've been so out of shape that like one run down the field and we're out of breath, like panting the whole rest.
Well, dude, this football game is going to be short. I think like it's just going to go fast, running clock. It'll be over before you know it.
I've dislocated this left knee here that you see,
yeah,
four times, and that's probably the leading reason why I don't want to.
Can I see it, Potsy?
Sure, a fifth.
Can I see if, like, to the naked eye, you can tell if?
So not really.
It looks healthy to me.
Skinny leg, but if I have my leg at the perfect angle, you can tell that there's nothing but cartilage in there. It's rough.
Potsy, you're looking old man hobbling around here.
It's all from. I'd love to say that it's all from basketball. About half of those dislocations are from basketball. One of those dislocations happened in chapel.
Whoa.
Oh, yeah.
Due to chapel injury. That's real.
Yeah, no. I was just praising a little too hard, I guess. And I backed up against the seat and I fell down into the theater seat. And on the way down, it popped out and back into place. And I just kind of sat there for a second.
Was that a very painful moment?
More scary. Just more of a surprise and then relief that it went immediately back in. Because people were like, "You okay there?" And I was like, "If I explain it, you won't believe me."
That's true.
That was fun. Let's go ahead and get into our first topic, me and Jackson's long-running debate.
Yeah, so we've had this conversation a couple times before, actually, in regards to what we each consider to be good art.
Okay.
Sort of. Let me make my case, because yours is kind of a rebuttal to that case.
Okay.
So I feel there's a difference between what you consider to be the best movies of all time and what you consider to be your favorite movies of all time.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Meaning that Jackson has a compelling argument.
Dude, I want to hear both sides. And can I just say, Jackson's voice is magnificent. Like, I've never really, like, listened to it in this context. He's got a really great radio voice, Potsy, don't you think?
Jackson blushes.
I mean, I don't know what to say.
Yeah, as soon as you get to the point where you can stop making it sound like you're eating a cookie time, it'll be...
I forgot a water bottle today too, so
it's bad. It's deep and full, and it's humbling of mine, my high pitched little middle school voice. So let me finish my, I guess, theory. Can you call it that? Maybe so.
Theory,
whatever. So for example, picture the old Michael Bay Transformers movies, right? I acknowledge they're not that great. That being said, I'm going to love them every time I watch them, and they're not going to hold up. They're not going to get any better with time. But I love them anyway.
But Potsy, wouldn't you say that love is housed in a whole bunch of externals that may or may not have anything to do with the movie itself? Like the age you were when you saw the first Transformers, or watching it with your dad, or some kind of like nostalgic vibe that these movies bring.
For me, it was probably the first time I'd ever seen CGI utilized to that extent.
Yeah.
And it was just kind of like mind-blowing for like a middle school kid. Like, totally. Whoa, that's insane. Like, it's almost beautiful art in itself, aside from the fact that the plot was garbage. But Jackson, why don't you go ahead and give your...
So I would say that whatever makes a movie good is completely up to the individual. So your favorite movie and the best movie are the same because it's your favorite because it is the best. It is the best because it's your favorite.
Okay, I actually completely agree with Buddy on this. And it's my compelling argument for like why there are no guilty pleasures, So we have this phrase in media consumption, the guilty pleasure, which means somehow I'm supposed to be embarrassed of a movie that I love. But if I love the movie, then to me it's a great movie.
You love it because it appeals to you.
Absolutely.
On one thing that, like you say about the Transformers movie, is that the plot is lacking.
Weak.
But the CGI is maybe great. So sure. I don't think it's necessarily a combination. Everything about a movie has to be good for it to be the best. But if you can enjoy even one aspect of it that makes it your favorite, then that makes it the best.
Right. And so a thing that comes up is just, this actually started because one of our friends asked us to rank all the Marvel movies, which we won't get into because that's a dead topic. But I wanted to make two different lists of how I felt they listed in order via what was the best and what was the worst. And then I wanted to make a separate list of which ones I enjoyed the most, the least. And I felt that those were two separate lists. And so that's kind of where this discussion birthed.
Well, dude, okay. I think I actually agree with both of you guys. So if you look at a franchise that's a little bit near and dear to my heart, the Rocky franchise.
Okay.
So if we take all the Rocky movies, right, starting with the first Rocky, 1976, Best Picture, won the Oscar, all the way up through Creed II, right? To me, the best film, right, the best story, the best script, the freshest cinematography, all of that was housed in the original Rocky. But the one that's the most fun to watch, the one that's to me the most nostalgic, is Rocky IV. Came out in 1985, squarely in the middle of my childhood. It was a Christmas movie. He fights the Russians. The Russians were like Apex Mountain in terms of movie villains in the 80s. It was the height of the Cold War.
We talked about that too, actually.
Dude, the movie is hot garbage, right? It's 86 minutes, probably 55 minutes of which is montage, right? Yeah. I mean, it's just trash, but it's so fun to watch. Drago's all like jacked and steroidal, and he's the perfect villain, and Rocky's all steroidal, but it's just a great movie. So it's a great movie. It's a fun movie. It's definitely not the best in the franchise in terms of quality, but if both movies are on cable at the same time, I'm probably watching Rocky IV.
Interesting.
Okay.
Yeah.
That puts a lot, that gives a new perspective on a lot of our thoughts.
Yeah, it does.
You're actually the first person that we've come to with this debate that's ever given Jackson any love.
Yeah.
Well, dude, everyone
seems to disagree with.
No, I agree with you, buddy. People are so hung up on quality, you know, and it's, especially in college, you kind of have to like put on this persona of, you know, I've gotten some education now, so I'm able to ascertain what's quality and what's trash. And I think when you're an old man like me, you're a feeble old man, you just get to the age where, like, you're not trying to show off for anybody anymore. It's like, look, if I want to watch this trash movie, I'm going to watch it, I'm going to enjoy every second, and I don't have to defend myself to anyone.
It's like you start to enjoy feeling like you get to have the hard critic's voice. It makes you feel something about yourself, right?
Yeah, I can see that.
Mm-hmm. Dude, I think, too, because I've spent so much of my life writing, and I've taken those critiques so personally. Like, when somebody would give me a bad review of my book, I mean, it just wrecked me, right? So at some level, I think the last thing I ever want to do is really wreck somebody in a critique. So I find it hard to critique somebody's movie, even if I think it's not great, just because I know how hard it is to make anything. It's hard to write a movie. It's hard to write a good article, you know, as you guys know now. But it's just tough to really stand back and lob stones at somebody's thing.
Yeah, I think where your philosophy, I started to finally understand where you were coming from, is when I started to apply the same thing to music. Because in the world of music, there might be something that's considered objectively not as good of a song as something else. But you might like it more because music, we identify a lot more with our personal taste. In the world of film, you kind of identify more with just the general craft. And so with music, I can definitely get behind that argument of like, well, it works for me, and so therefore it's a better song.
I think to relate that to a specific artist, I've been listening to like a lot of Bob Dylan lately.
Ooh. Like,
Bob Dylan's voice isn't like good.
Dude, which era Bob Dylan are you listening to? Like raspy late career Bob Dylan?
Yeah.
That's my favorite Bob.
Yeah, I mean, and he's enjoyable to listen to, but his voice is grating sometimes. Like, it doesn't sound
totally.
It doesn't sound good, like what most people would define as.
Dude, so I think music is even more of a moving target than movies, in that music is almost entirely housed in our emotions, right? So I played a song the other day in class, "Waking Up in Vegas" by Katy Perry. which is one of my favorite Katy Perry songs. It's so much fun to listen to, right? But in the in the pantheon of like music of the world, it will be forgotten. It will not be remembered as a great song on any level, but it makes me happy and it's fun to listen to. So I think that's we tend to kind of be more forgiving in terms of music because it is so wrapped up in emotion.
Mm-hmm.
I think I would apply this, I guess, theory, as we call them, to just about any form of art. So movies, music, TV.
Film seems to be the one where people just tend to be more like stuck up and like wrapped up in being right or wrong.
There seems to be more of a process in making film
there's a lot more elements going in.
Yeah.
Liz, I have a question for you on this topic. Would you say that as viewers we wrap up more of our identity in the stuff that we like movie wise, which I think is why people are so ride or die with their movie opinions, you know, just the sense that, let's say I defend some Tarantino picture, right? And I go to war over this picture and I defend it. It feels like more of me is housed in liking that movie or being right or what it says about me. Whereas I think we're a little more forgiving when it comes to music. Would you agree with that?
I can possibly get behind that.
Like we use movies to build our identity more. You know,
I'd probably do more of that with music myself.
Interesting.
Just as someone who works myself in music more than film. But no, I definitely see that. I think I've said before multiple times that I feel that Baby Driver has a claim to possibly being one of the best films, if not the of all time.
I think it's in my top three.
And a lot of that comes to just relating to the central character Ansel Elgort that you brought up in class, actually.
Let me lay another Baby Driver theory on you. And this is pure conjecture based on how old you guys are. I would posit that maybe Baby Driver was the first like film you ever saw, in the sense that, you know, you kind of grew up on the steady diet of Marvel and Michael Bay.
I would 100% agree with you.
Yeah, so it was your first film. It was this big moment of, wow, like this is super entertaining. The pace is great. The performances are incredible. The music
originality
is,
of it.
Yeah, the music is so unbelievable. Huge for me. But you know you're watching something special from an artistic standpoint. And for me, like for my generation, that movie was Pulp Fiction. So it was early Tarantino where you're getting your mind blown by all the stuff he's doing with chronology and all the like careers he's resurrecting in Pulp Fiction. For you guys, I think it was Baby Driver, but that's a magical moment in the sense of you get to feel smarter. You get to feel like I've seen something special, something different. You know what I mean?
I think there's a lot of comparisons to be made between Tarantino and Edgar Wright. Like they're,
true.
There's some of the, I think last like real, like not quite independent, but independent filmmakers, and they've got that independent movie.
Yeah, that independent spirit where it kind of breaks the Hollywood formula a little bit, and they're getting away with it.
Yeah,
it's working.
Edgar Wright's a bit polarizing with people that I've talked to. I know I have friends that hate his movies, all of them, and didn't go to Baby Driver because of that.
Dude, who hates his movies? That's fascinating.
I don't
don't have to name names, but I'm just,
maybe Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz. Those just didn't work for some people.
Dude, I love those movies.
I love both of those movies.
I feel like they're so funny and so clever.
In fact, I think I actually prefer Hot Fuzz. I really love that movie.
Yeah.
It's just there's a lot of moving pieces going on, and it's just they're funny.
There's a third one. Is it?
There is World's a third End one. That one I actually haven't seen. It's like a bar at the end of the world, and they're trying to like go to every bar that leads up to it or something like that. And like the apocalypse is happening in the background or something like that.
I think it's a little less well liked than the previous.
Yeah,
two,
but it completes his like trilogy with those actors of those types of films.
Yeah.
So that's one we got to get around to. But I like that you brought up the similarities between Edgar Wright and Tarantino, because I hadn't previously thought about that, but I agree. And Tarantino is actually our next topic for today. Fun fact, his movie that came out this summer, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, was my introduction.
Really?
Yeah, and I'm not proud to say that because there's a lot of films that I've been wanting to watch of his.
Potsy, that's okay. Did you love the movie, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
I did.
Good.
And here's the thing. We will talk spoilers on this podcast because it's a little impossible not to. And the movie has been out for a while now.
Yeah.
Even without the climatic ending that it had, I still think I would have loved it.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, it was interesting because like there wasn't a whole lot of substance throughout in terms of action, which is what Tarantino is kind of known for, but there was still something there. And
yeah.
And it was weird because it just built and built and built for like 2 solid hours and then it exploded. And it was something else. I think it was a really unique movie, but again, Tarantino's known for making unique movies that he wants to make, so.
Totally, yeah, total 2 hours of character stuff, right? Brad and Leo, their friendship. I would watch 2 hours of Brad and Leo watching TV together. That was one of my favorite scenes.
That's how I felt during
the movie. where they hung out in Leo's house. They were watching the show that Leo was just on and just bantering. I just thought that was magic. That scene just like totally popped for me.
Because they both just, they killed their roles. And
yeah.
The big argument that a lot of people have with that movie is that it was just, you know, these two guys going through their day without any sort of plot. But I was like, well, their day's intriguing.
If it's the right two guys, it always works. Right. And it was the right two guys because the script was good and because the two guys were maybe the most wildly charismatic people that all three of us will ever see in our lifetimes. Right. And they were on screen together at the same time, which was just bananas.
You have to be a fan of the slow burn to appreciate this movie.
Yeah. Totally.
For sure. And is that something that's typical of Tarantino in his films, would you say?
No, because my favorite Tarantino is Inglourious Basterds. And that one really... There's not a slow scene in it.
Yeah, okay. No,
that's one on my list to watch.
Yeah, every scene is a banger.
It's nerve-wracking.
It really is, man. And even the quiet scenes, even the talky scenes. So, like, the opening scene.
Oh, my word. It's
dude, it's like 18 minutes long, and it's all talk, but it's so tense, right? It's so, so tense, and the movie just moves in that way. So I think this Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is another proof of Tarantino's just willingness to push himself and willingness to stay out of even the formulas that he's created, right? You look at his body of work and there's all kinds of creativity in the early years going on with chronology. You know, he's done interesting stuff with pacing. He just, I think, continues to push himself, which is why the movies are so interesting.
Yeah, Pulp Fiction definitely has some different pacing, like it jumps around chronologically, but like everyone seems to like it's such a weird movie that almost everyone could agree on saying this is a good movie.
Right. Well, if you were like a smug film guy in college in the 90s, that was the movie that you sort of swung around in front of other people to make sure they knew how smart you were. And
Baby Driver is that.
Baby Driver's right totally now. That
that's
for you
100%
guys.
The case.
Yeah, so if you were like the guy in the beret in your dorm or the scarf over the t-shirt. We were talking about Pulp Fiction and Tarantino. I was not that guy. I was like a meathead and I was pretty sheltered. Like I hadn't seen a lot of things. And I remember like being intrigued by Pulp Fiction, but not exactly liking it. And it's far from my favorite Tarantino. I liked Reservoir Dogs a lot better. Inglourious Basterds, Django, this one. Those are all like higher up the food chain for me than Pulp Fiction.
Daniel, you mentioned this was your first exposure to Tarantino. My first exposure was kind of funny if you think about it. So it was Reservoir Dogs, which I think is his first movie.
Yeah.
But it was with my Baptist preacher dad.
Okay.
Which is it's a weird movie to watch with your dad.
It's
totally pretty intense. It's
so intense.
A lot of F-bombs, a lot of blood.
But now, was your Baptist preacher dad like the kind of guy who would watch edgy films, or was this sort of a new foray for him as well?
No, he liked it. He said he had watched it with his buddies, and he's like, yeah, you should see this movie. It's good. And I'm like, okay. So we watched it together. I was like, why is he showing me, like, what the heck? This is not. It definitely wasn't the normal kind of movie we watched together. But we both loved it. Like it's. Again, it's different, but it's fun.
That's a cool dad moment by him, too. Mm-hmm. What's the first, like, real movie you remember watching with your dad and getting really stoked about? Do you guys remember?
Dude, I could say Star Wars.
That's a great one.
I had a PSP, and I had Lego Star Wars on it. And he's like, he saw me playing, and he's like, have you ever actually seen those movies? And I was like, nah. He's like, let's go. And we went to the movie rental place.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Got for the original trilogy.
Dude, I love that there's a movie rental place in the story, too. That's kind of a thing in the past that was a huge part of, like, my childhood, my college experience.
So my Baptist preacher dad.
You guys both have Baptist preacher dads?
Yes, sir.
That's incredible, boys.
In fact, I don't even know. We didn't know that for a while, or it just never came up in conversation. But he had this cabinet in his home office that was just filled with franchises. And yeah. He grew up on, he was really big into the Star Treks and the Lost in Space and Star Wars and like anything that.
He was a big space guy.
Yep, that was his thing. That was his nerd realm. And mm-hmm. so he had all of these franchises. He had to buy each of the films that came out in something. There was a part of him that just loved like trilogies existing, the fact that they even could happen. And so he would have box sets. And as I got older, you know, like 10, 11, 12, he would just slowly start introducing me to them in order. And like, I remember the first one, I don't remember my age, but the first one he introduced me to was actually Pirates of the Caribbean.
That okay.
was the first trilogy he ever introduced me to, but he just came up and he said, put these in and watch them all in order. And then we slowly from there went up through Star Wars, Indiana Jones, just all these different series. And I remember I would be so excited because he would walk up with some box from the cabinet and be like, okay, here's 10 more hours of stuff that you have to see. And I'd be like, let's go. It was awesome.
Dude, isn't there something sweet about a dad like transmitting the parts of his culture down to his kids, man? And I can say from a dad's perspective, my kids are 17 and 13. There's like so much joy in that moment where you get to take something cool, something timeless, even something kind of like poppy and fun from when you were young and you get to share it with your kids. It's just magic, man. That's such a good moment. And it's why I hope we always have like movies in some sort of hard copy form that we can pass to our kids. So
yeah, we're going all digital now.
We're going all digital now, and like it's fine, but I've got a house full of DVDs, man. I love DVDs. I got so many DVDs, and I like to be able to, like you said, like hand them to the kid and say, watch this.
Tell me what you think about this. So movie watching culture for us today as college students is it's Friday. It's 6 to 8 people, maybe 5 to 6 in a dorm, and it's somebody spending $3 to rent a movie that everyone's kind of semi-interested in on YouTube, and then you play it on the background, but no one actually watches it, and you have a conversation, and then 2 days later, so-and-so in your group will be talking to somebody else and be like, oh yeah, I watched that movie once one time. It was good.
Potsy, that literally makes me insane.
Me too.
Baby, listen to me.
Both of us. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
To me, like, the movie is the main event. Respect the movie.
Right.
Don't sit and chat. Like, you can be silent for 2 hours, right? The world can live without your...
That's hard for our friends. That's
hard. But, like, dude, you got to respect the movie, man. Some filmmaker, like, had blood, sweat, and tears over this thing to bring it into existence, and you're going to, like, sit there and text during it or, like... chat with your friends.
Well, I think they just feel like it's $3 out of their wallet and they're watching an extended YouTube video. Like, that's how they feel about it.
Potsy, that is a fascinating insight, man. Jackson, you were going to speak to that.
So we were watching, I don't know, some movie. It's mainly just me and you, but your roommates were in and out.
They were coming in and out during different scenes. Oh,
not only that.
Oh, I hate when people ask you questions about, like, catch me up to this point. And I'm like, no, you're not going to appreciate it.
And not only that, I was receiving like phone calls back and forth.
And so we were pausing it for 10 minutes at a time.
Oh, it was
thankfully
rough.
It wasn't a great movie.
Yeah.
We
didn't
ruin the experience. But
and we kind of opened that one and watched it because it wasn't going to be
the main event. But
there definitely are movies that should be the main event when you pop them in. You don't just put Pulp Fiction in the background. You gotta
dude,
watch
that. Man, you gotta dial it in, you gotta pay attention. Inglourious Bastards, same thing. There's so much subtlety. I mean, you can watch that movie 10 times and still learn from it. And to imagine a scenario in which people are coming in and out of the room or like talking over it, it just hurts, man.
We've been planning a weekend binge of Tarantino for a little bit, and we'll probably get around to it at some point. It's just a matter of finding.
We're
kind of
hoping to get it before
we were
this
I wanted to have the perspectives of someone who just got introduced to Tarantino and didn't know if the slow burn was typical of his films or not.
And the
fact that it's not, and that you're saying he has a versatile kind of career to pull from, that's enticing. That makes me want to watch more of what he's got.
One thing that isn't, I don't know, quite typical, but it's actually popped up in two of his movies now, Inglourious Bastards and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. He's kind of rewritten history in a weird way.
Yeah.
And I think that's super interesting and maybe a talking point. Would either of you like to talk on that?
Sometimes that's a hard...
Or I guess...
Yeah, I would like to.
That's a hard trope to try to pull off.
Yeah.
You can lead to a lot of frustration. He played around with, famous American deaths in this most recent movie.
And in Inglourious Basterds, I mean, he just killed Hitler.
Like, he kills Hitler in Inglourious Basterds. He kind of reimagines, like, American slavery and that sort of thing in Django Unchained. I actually... Okay, so here's a Tarantino theory that I've been kicking around Potsy for like 20 years. My theory is, and I think I laid this on you guys at class at some point, but for me, in order to make a film really great, right, or even to have a starting point for a really good movie, it's got to be almost equal parts total depravity of man, right? So this theological concept which says, you guys are pastor's kids, you know it, that apart from Christ, we're totally depraved. We're dead in our trespasses, right? And this is a huge part of the world, the world around us.
A huge part of Tarantino movies.
And a huge part of Tarantino movies, right? So for a film to be successful, it's got to be equal parts that, and also equal parts the reality that we're created in God's image, which is also true, right? We're image bearers. So for me, early Tarantino, so like Pulp Fiction era Tarantino, it was off the charts total depravity, and it was very low on created in God's image. Now, this reimagining history moment for Tarantino, to me, has, like, leveled out the scales a little bit, where it's still gritty, it's still dark, it still acknowledges depravity, but it brings in a little crackle of hopefulness. There's a little sense of, we're created in God's image, this isn't all dark, there's some justice, and to me, that's been really pleasant, and I've actually loved this revisionist history Tarantino era that we're in, man. I hope he keeps doing them.
Yeah, it's interesting the kind of weird justice. I say that with air quotes because, like, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, it's brutal.
It's so brutal.
It's messed up. And it's
yeah, it's so brutal.
I remember sitting there in the theater. It was actually just me and one other guy, my friend, and we were like just screaming out in the theater there because no one else was there. And like the final scene, the whole movie up to that point's been. Not slow. It's been interesting, certainly, but again, it's that slow build.
Yeah.
And it kicks off immediately right at that scene.
Yeah.
And it is brutal to watch. But
dude, it's so brutal.
At the same time, it's weirdly enjoyable.
Yes.
It was like refreshing. It was like when you're thirsty for just so long and you finally get a hold of something.
but you're not drinking like pure water. You're drinking like something.
You're drinking like sewage.
Yeah, like it's huge. It's just
thirst quenching sewage.
Yeah, you're like drinking out of a ditch rather than like pure water.
Exactly.
It's more just like, but it's still relieving.
Yeah.
It's odd, and it's almost.
Well, it's relieving because I think you're, and the movie did a great job of not showing its cards in the sense that, as that like right before that last scene was about to unfold, like there was a large part of me that thought that car full of hippies was going to go and kill Sharon Tate, right?
Yeah.
And then it goes the other way, which is fascinating. But I really didn't know up until that moment what was going to happen. Mm. And I had an inkling that it might go the way it did. But you're right. It was refreshing. It was relieving at some level. Did you guys love it when Brad beat up the hippie earlier in the movie?
Oh yeah, they give you little
like droplets, like little trickles of violence. So you got that. You got the Bruce Lee fight scene.
Yeah,
which was
great.
So funny. Yeah, and so kind of low key and understated, but yeah, great Tarantino.
Yeah, there's
stuff.
Like
really
this
fun.
Huge buildup of like this promised moment of serious violence, and you're like, well, is this going to go the other way and not be fun to watch? But then it totally veers off of history and. It's fun.
Let me ask you guys a question about that movie. And this is a dad question. I really want to show it to my 17-year-old. Do you think it's too much for him? Should I wait a couple years or should I pull the trigger on that?
I think I was 17 when I watched Pulp Fiction or Reservoir Dogs.
Okay.
Certainly so a case-by-case basis.
Yeah. He's seen a lot of, like, I've let him see a lot of things, so I think he could maybe handle it. But he's never done a Tarantino. So...
I mean, maybe
it definitely doesn't get too
Tarantino.
Intense to the end.
Yeah.
I actually remember thinking in the theater that whole around the middle of the film, that scene where Brad Pitt's character, I can't remember the name. Anyone remember the name?
I don't. Not right off
Rick
the top.
Rick Dalton?
Rick.
That sounds very close.
Rick may have been the Leo character,
yeah,
but
maybe.
Close enough.
But definitely the film. Anyway, point is that entire scene where he's on the Manson family farm.
Oh.
I wanted that to erupt so badly. And then the way that it didn't, I remember it didn't. I was like, well, that's kind of a bummer, but there was a purpose for that.
Dude, it was so tense. It was part of the build, right? Mm-hmm, it was part of the slow burn, the slow build of this thing where they just give you a taste. And I think throughout the movie, they show you, and this is a great character thing, right? This is why I love Tarantino doing this kind of thing. They show you how dangerous Brad's character can be. You know, they give you these little glimpses, even the little flashback scene of him and his estranged wife on the boat. They give you that little snippet. They give you the stuff that unfolds at the hippie farm. They give you Bruce Lee. And by the end of it, you're like, this guy's really dangerous, you know? He seems cool and he seems so chill and laid back, but he can really do some damage.
I remember seeing comments on social media of people that were trashing the movie, like, we walked out before it was over. I was like, well, that was a shame.
No kidding.
You shouldn't have done that.
Dude, why on earth would you do that? Were they just bored? They thought it was too talky or too, like,
I mean, I imagine directionless that or whatever. The take that they had. I just thought that was funny that, you know, if you'd just waited, you know, 20 more minutes.
Yeah, you would have gotten the big Tarantino payoff that you were waiting for.
As far as the letting your son watch it, I mean, I guess that depends on what your kid is influenced by right now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think,
what does he pick up and take with him to school?
And this is a fascinating, like, Christian parenting discussion on the level of, like, I know that his heart has been changed by Christ, so he's regenerate. I think as much as you can be at age 17, he's pretty serious about his faith. I mean, he's a faithful, you know, pay attention in church guy, and we pray together. And so I know that he's rooted in that sense. But he is, you know, like a lot of 17-year-old boys, influenced by things that he thinks are awesome. Like, he's just looking for the awesome moment, you know, like, whether it's in music or whether it's in a movie. Like, this summer, we did the whole John Wick trilogy together.
Oh, yeah.
And it was so fun, you guys. It was so, so fun. And he was, like, he was connecting with the awesomeness of the set design. And, you know, the stories were simple enough, but they were good. And we enjoyed, you know, Keanu's quote-unquote acting of that role together. We thought it was perfect. And so we were connecting on all these kind of aesthetic levels with John Wick. So I think, in a sense, he would be ready for Tarantino. But the argument against it, and I want to hear you guys on this too, I guess, and this is another, like, vestige of being an old man now, there are aspects of my innocence that I wish I could have back, or that I wish I had just clung to for a little longer, you know? I wish I could have stayed a little more innocent for a little longer. And, you know, as a parent, the last thing I want to do is advertently or inadvertently harden his heart. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And if maybe showing him too much too soon would have a heart hardening effect, then that's the last thing I want to do.
I'll say that my parents kept things pretty safe.
Mm-hmm.
They definitely leaned more towards the sheltered lifestyle. That being said, there were moments of freedom throughout. My years growing up, and because I chose to handle those in the correct way, that in turn led to more freedom and complete trust as I was getting older. And so, I don't know, Jackson, would you say that you had a similar experience?
Yeah, I think sometimes sharing something that is questionable with your kid can be better than them just maybe stumbling upon it
when they're, like, in college or whatever.
You give them the opportunity to experience how they're going to react to that kind of thing while you're still with them.
Yeah.
And I think there's something to be said for that.
Absolutely.
I feel like both of you guys had cool dads. Now, like, as pastor's kids, this is a cliche question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Did you guys have, like, the big rebellion? Did you feel really at odds with that at any point?
Really, no.
You did?
Yeah.
Interesting.
15, 16.
Okay. And was it like specific to being a pastor's kid, or more just like kind of asking the big questions about church and faith? And
it wasn't even necessarily associated with that.
Okay.
It was just, I was 15, 16 years old and I didn't want to listen to my dad anymore. It's looking back on it now.
Yeah.
Super childish thing.
Yeah. But also pretty common, I think.
Sure.
Yeah.
And, like, I mean, it led to arguments and fights, and it wasn't fun, and it was just, neither one of us liked that period, and it was gross, and it passed because, I mean, we both matured. Me morally, that's not a word. Me more because I needed to. So.
Sure. Man, it gives me hope to hear you guys talk about that. I mean, it's just encouraging as a parent to know that, you know, this kind of growth and progress is possible.
For me, it was certainly more the faith questions.
Yeah.
Is my faith legitimate?
Yeah.
That kind of battle that you have? Mm-hmm. Or is it just a product of this household that I've grown up in?
Patsy, I wish everybody at Union would ask that question.
It's an important one.
Now, let me ask you this. Do you feel free and or encouraged to ask that question at Union? I hope the answer is yes. I know that's a leading question, but...
To my circle, yes. But okay. That may not be true of every student.
Got you. Yeah, I guess on the faculty side, my hope is that would always be yes. You know, I'm always privileged when people come to me with questions like that, and I can think of no better way to spend my time. But I do think there's a large percentage of our campus that feels uncomfortable having those kind of talks, and I wish they would feel more comfortable.
For sure. Well, this timed out well. Thank you for coming on with us.
Dude, thank you for having me. This was a blast,
you
guys.
This is really great.
I would always love to talk movies with you guys, even off the air, man. You guys are so smart and thoughtful, and you do a great job with the show. I listened to the flagship episode, the pilot, as it were.
Which was recorded with intention to not be released. Maybe that's why it wasn't. Maybe that's why
it was
so good,
man. You guys were relaxed. You were just going off the cuff, having fun. But no, I appreciate you guys, and thankful that you're in my program.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.